Chapter 1. Pandora's Daughters. It is hard to be precise about the origins of a prejudice, but if misogyny has a birthday, it falls sometime in the 8th century BC. If it has a cradle, it lies somewhere in the eastern Mediterranean. At around that time, in both Greece and Judea, creation stories that were to acquire the power of myth arose, describing the fall of man and how woman's weakness is responsible for all subsequent human suffering, misery, and death. Both myths have since flowed into the mainstream of Western civilization, carried along by two of its most powerful tributaries. In the Jewish tradition, as recounted in Genesis, which a majority of Americans still accept as true, the culprit is Eve, and in the Greek, Pandora. The Greeks are the first colonists of our intellectual world. Their vision of a universe governed by natural laws that the human intellect can uncover and comprehend is the basis on which our science and philosophy rest. They created the first democracy. But in the history of misogyny, the Greeks also occupy a unique place as the intellectual pioneers of a pernicious view of women that has persisted down to modern times, confounding any notion we might still have that the rise of reason and science means the decline of prejudice and hatred. The myth of Pandora was first written down in the 8th century BC by Hesiod, a farmer-turned-poet, in two poems, Theogony and Works and Days. In spite of Hesiod's considerable experience as a farmer, his account of mankind's creation ignores some of the basic facts of life. The race of men exists before the arrival of woman, in blissful autonomy, as companions to the gods, apart from sorrow and from painful work, free from disease. As in the biblical account of the creation of man, woman is an afterthought. But in the Greek version, she is also a most malicious one. Zeus, the father of the gods, seeks to punish men by keeping from them the secret of fire, so that, like the beasts, they must eat their meat raw. Prometheus, a demigod and the creator of the first men, steals fire from heaven and brings it to earth. Furious at being deceived, Zeus devises the supreme trick in the form of a gift to men, an evil thing for their delight, Pandora, the all-giver. The Greek phrase used to describe her, kalon kakon, means the beautiful evil. Her beauty compares to that of the goddesses. From her comes all the race of womankind, the deadly female race and tribe of wives who live with mortal men and bring them harm. The gods give her sly manners and the morals of a bitch. Pandora is presented to Epimetheus, Prometheus's younger brother. He is enchanted by this hopeless trap, deadly to men, and marries her. Pandora brings with her a large sealed jar, which she has been told never to open. The jar is an earthenware vessel, womb-like in shape, and primarily used to store wine and olive oil. In earlier times, it was also used as a coffin. Pandora cannot resist seeing what is inside. But now the woman opened up the cask and scattered pains and evils among men. Since then, according to Greek mythology, mankind has been doomed to labour, grow old, get sick, and die in suffering. One of the functions of mythology is to answer the sort of questions we asked as children, such as, why do the stars shine, and why did Granddad die? Myths also justify the existing order of things, both natural and social, and account for traditional beliefs, rituals, and roles. One of the beliefs most central to the Greek, and later the Judeo-Christian traditions, was that man was fashioned by the gods, or God, separately from the creation of animals. The persistence of this belief among conservative Christians is why Darwin's theory of evolution continues to meet with such resistance. The possession of fire was proof that man was different from the animals, and also further up the hierarchy of species. But fire's acquisition brought man too close to the gods for their comfort. Woman, it was said, is his punishment for this hubris, a reminder that man, regardless of his origins and aspirations, comes into the world as does a lowly beast. Today, some have turned this attitude of contempt on its head, celebrating woman because of what they see as her closer links to nature. But to the Greeks, Nature was a threat and a challenge to man's higher self, and woman was nature's most powerful, because most alluring, embodiment. It was necessary to dehumanize her, even though she made it possible for the human race to continue. Contempt was her due for exciting the lust that leads us into the cycle of birth and death, from which we can never break free. As well as burdening Pandora with responsibility for the mortal lot of man, the Greeks created a vision of woman as the other, the antithesis to the male thesis, who needed boundaries to contain her. Most crucially, Greece laid the philosophical scientific foundations for a dualistic view of reality in which women were forever doomed to embody this mutable and essentially contemptible world. Any history of the attempt to dehumanize half the human race is confronted by this paradox that some of the values we cherish most were forged in a society that devalued, denigrated, and despised women. Sex roles that will be familiar to the modern reader were firmly established in the Dark Ages in Athens, wrote the historian Sarah Pomeroy. That is, along with Plato and the Parthenon, Greece gave us some of the cheapest sexual dichotomies of all, including that of good girl versus bad girl. Hesiod was writing some 5 centuries after tribes who would become the Greeks had swept into the eastern Mediterranean as conquerors, establishing themselves not only on the Greek mainland, but also in the islands around it and on the shores of Asia Minor, modern Turkey. By the 6th century BC, the Greeks had spread as far west as Sicily, the coasts of southern Italy, and the southeast coast of Gaul, now France. They brought with them their pantheon of warrior gods, of whom the most powerful was Zeus, the Thunderer. Having violent warrior divinities, however, is not necessarily an indication of a misogynistic culture. In the older civilizations the Greeks encountered, such as those of Egypt and Babylon, there was an abundance of war gods, but no equivalent of the fall of man myth. In Mesopotamia, the Sumerian poem The Epic of Gilgamesh, which dates back to the 3rd millennium BC, has a hero who, like Prometheus, aspires to rival the gods. Gilgamesh does so by seeking to share in their immortality. But women are not made the instrument of revenge by some vindictive deity seeking to punish man for challenging his mortal lot. Nor does Gilgamesh castigate women for being to blame for the lot of man. The gods are to blame for our mortality. The goddess who rules paradise tells him, "Gilgamesh, where are you hurrying to? You will never find that life for which you are looking. When the gods created man, they allotted him death, but life they retained in their own keeping. As for you, Gilgamesh, fill up your belly with good things, day and night, night and day, dance and be merry, feast and rejoice. Let your clothes be fresh, bathe yourself in water, cherish the little child that holds your hand, and make your wife happy in your embrace. For this, too, is the lot of man." In the later culture of the nomadic Celts, which dominated northwestern Europe, myths of paradise found and lost abound, but there is no myth of the fall of man. The Celtic version of paradise is, like that of the Sumerians and Jews, a fruitful garden where beautiful women rule and lure men to a life of bliss. But the only conflict is between the men's nostalgia for home and their desire for the women of the garden. Desire exists, but the evil consequences do not. There is no Celtic equivalent of Pandora or Eve. The gods of the Athenian pantheon, traditionally located on Mount Olympus, became the national gods of Greece with several prominent characteristics. 4 of the 5 major goddesses are either virginal or asexual. The most important of them, Athena, is as androgynous as the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. She is usually shown holding a shield and spear, clad in helmet and long thick robes that conceal her body. The 5th goddess, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, behaves at times like a celestial airhead. The sexlessness of most of the female deities is in startling contrast to the violent, predatory nature of the males. Most significantly, the Athenian pantheon established a serial rapist, the sky god Zeus, as the father of them all. Zeus's numerous offspring are nearly all the product of the rape of mortal women. The 2 exceptions are Athena and Dionysus, to whom Zeus gives birth himself, Athena springs from his head, fully armed, carrying her spear and shield, and Dionysus emerges from his thigh. All religions ask us to believe the impossible. The fantasy of male autonomy, in which men are seen as somehow free from dependence on women, expresses itself in the creation myth of Pandora, where males can come into existence without females. In the Athenian pantheon, this impossibility expresses itself in the claim that males can make females redundant in the very sphere where they are indispensable, that of reproduction. Ludicrous as it might seem, the myth of the father of the gods becoming the mother of the gods was given force by the science of Aristotle, in which the role of the mother in pregnancy was determined to be merely nutritive. She was the passive receptacle of the male seed, which contained everything needed, except the environment, for the development of the fetus. Whatever the female can do, it seems, the male can do better, though there is no evidence of any Greek males rushing to experiment with impregnation and giving birth. The rise of misogyny in the 8th century BC Greece occurred just as the influence of family-based dynasties was on the decline. Instead, power was invested in the body politic of the city-state. One historian has suggested that where political power was rooted in the royal household, the boundary between the domestic and the political, between the private and the public, is not nearly so rigid. The roles of men and women overlap, and it is for this reason that a woman can come close, in the absence of her husband, to the exercise of political power. Alliances between noble families were of vital importance, and women's role in forging such bonds was essential. This is reflected in the work of Homer, Hesiod's more gifted contemporary. In the Iliad, the story of the siege of Troy, Menelaus, the king of Sparta and Helen's husband, owes his throne to his wife. For Menelaus, it is essential to get his wife back, after she has eloped with Paris to Troy, not just for her unrivalled beauty, but because his kingship depends on it. Homer based both the Iliad and the Odyssey, the latter recounting the long journey home of Odysseus, one of the Greek kings, on material which dates back to the earlier dynastic period. In these works, women are generally portrayed sympathetically. They are complex and powerful, and among the most memorable characters in all literature. The end of this era was accompanied by a move from a pastoral to a labour-intensive agricultural economy, one concerned about the conservation of property. But the expressions of hostility to women, not only in Hesiod, but in other extant 8th-century writings, cannot be entirely explained by changing political and social structures. No deep-seated hatred can. They provided, however, the context in which men felt comfortable in expressing misogyny. And the woman against whom they felt most comfortable expressing it was an 8th-century creation, Helen of Troy, Greek misogyny's centrefold, the face that launched 1,000 ships and burned the topless towers of Ilium. Helen's mother, Leda, was one of Zeus's rape victims, whom he violated when he was in the form of a swan. But Helen, in her remarkable career as a complex icon inciting both desire and loathing, is more truly a daughter of Pandora. Like Pandora's, her beauty is a trick. It arouses extraordinary desire in men. But to desire her is to uncork the evils of bloodshed and destruction. In the Iliad, Helen expresses self-loathing, describing herself as a nasty bitch, evil intriguing. She echoes the description of Pandora. At the peak of Athens' most creative period, when self-loathing becomes a generalized feeling among the female characters of some of the great dramas, Helen is the focal point of misogyny. She is the manslaughterer, man's curse, bitch, vampire, destroyer of cities, the poisoned chalice, devourer of men. Almost every misogynistic epithet imaginable is thrown at her. In Euripides' The Trojan Women, Hecuba, the widow of Priam, the slaughtered king of Troy, cries out to Menelaus, the victorious Spartan king, "I bless thee, Menelaus, I bless thee, if thou wilt slay her. Only fear to see her visage, lest she snare thee and thou fall. She snareth strong men's eyes, she snareth tall cities, and fire from out her eateth up houses. Such magic hath she as a cup of death. Hecuba's pleas are in vain. Menelaus both needs and desires Helen too much to punish her. He carries her back to Sparta, where they resume their married life, while the other women, reduced to the status of the victor's slaves, are left to lament their lost husbands, fathers, and sons. Like that of Pandora, the story of Helen is an allegory that inextricably links desire with death. In the Pandora story, her loss of virginity, the uncorking of the jar, lets death into the world, just as Paris' desire for Helen brings war and all its horrors. Such allegories are expressions of what Sigmund Freud called the eternal struggle between Eros and the destructive or death instinct, Thanatos. In the culture of contempt, women are made to feel overwhelming guilt because their beauty causes desire, starting the cycle of life and death. Other mythologies and cultures have mediated this complex dance of Eros and Thanatos, but primarily as an inescapable act of life. In the mythology of the Celts, goddesses are typically identified with the principles of both life and death. These dual roles are not, however, seen dualistically. That is, as two principles of life and death forever at war. The Celts portray their goddesses as unself-consciously reconciling the forces of life and death in the way every mother does in reality. By bringing life into the world, she also brings death. This life-death reconciliation is, to them, simply in the nature of things, not a cause for blame or condemnation. But to the Greek dualistic mentality, nature embodies man's limitations and weaknesses, and woman embodies nature. Woman serves as a constant and resented reminder of those limitations. This is the sin of Pandora and her daughters, for which misogyny, from its fairy tales to its philosophies, seeks to punish all women. "One constant rule of mythology," wrote the poet Robert Graves, "is that whatever happens among the gods above reflects events on earth. Relationships and attitudes which are given mythological sanction are usually reflected in laws and customs. During the 6th century BC, this became evident with the growth of democracy and city-states such as Athens, which quickly developed restrictive codes to regulate women's behaviour. To modern minds, the notion that the rise of democracy should lead to a diminishing of women's status might seem to be something of a contradiction. But the notion of universal suffrage, or even of equality as it is understood now, did not inspire the democracies of Greece and Rome. They were slave-owning states where democratic rights were severely restricted to adult male citizens. In a slave-owning economy, the idea that all people are born equal would have contradicted a blatant reality, one that was as self-serving as it was universal. Slavery was the natural outcome of inherent inequalities. In a society where one form of gross inequality is institutionalized, it is easier for other forms of inequality to flourish as well. Laws regulating women's behavior and opportunities give the most graphic and pertinent examples of how Hesiod's allegory of misogyny became a social fact. Legally speaking, Athenian women remained children, always under the guardianship of a male. A woman could not leave the house unless accompanied by a chaperone. She seldom was invited to dinner with her husband and lived in a segregated area of the house. She received no formal education. "Let a woman not develop her reason, for that would be a terrible thing," said the philosopher Democritus. Women were married when they reached puberty, often to men twice their age. Such a difference in age and maturity, as well as in education, would have enhanced the notion of women's inferiority. The husband was warned, "He who teaches letters to his wife is ill-advised. He's giving additional poison to a snake." A husband's adultery was not considered grounds for divorce. This view prevailed in England up until 1923, a reflection of how deeply the classics permeated upper-class English culture. But if a woman committed adultery, or was raped, her husband was obliged to divorce her or lose his citizenship. With these threats, women in the world's first democracy were worse off than in the autocracy of ancient Babylon. There, under the laws of King Hammurabi, compiled in 1750 BC, the husband of a woman convicted of adultery at least had the power to pardon her. Having consensual sex with another man's wife in ancient Greece was regarded as a more serious offence than raping her. During the trial of a husband accused of murdering his wife's lover, the clerk of the court reads from the laws of Solon, the great Athenian lawgiver of the 6th century BC, regarding rape. Thus, members of the jury, the lawgiver considered violators deserving of a lesser penalty than seducers. For the latter, he provided the death penalty. For the former, the doubled fine. His idea was that those who use force are loathed by the persons violated, whereas those who have got their way by persuasion corrupt women's minds in such a way as to make other men's wives more attached to themselves than to their husbands, so that the whole house is in their power, and it is uncertain who is the children's father, the husband, or the lover. The defence of the husband was that he had the right to kill his wife's lover because he had caught them in flagrante. A raped woman suffered the same penalties as one accused of adultery, and was forbidden to take part in public ceremonies or to wear jewellery. As in many conservative Muslim societies today, the rape victim was regarded as responsible for her own violation. She became a social outcast, a terrible fate in the small, close-knit community of the city-state. Solon imposed further restrictions on women. He circumscribed their appearance at funerals, where traditionally they had provided contingents of paid mourners, and at feasts, as well as limiting their public displays of wealth. In addition, they were banned from buying or selling land. Solon also enacted a law forcing a woman without brothers on the death of her father to marry his nearest male relative. The sons born of that marriage would inherit any land. In this way, woman became the vehicle through which the property was kept within the family. Even after her marriage, an Athenian woman remained under the control of her father, who retained the power to divorce her from her husband and wed another if he decided that it was advantageous. Another law attributed to Solon forbade any Athenian citizen from enslaving another Athenian citizen, the enslavement of non-citizens was allowed, with one notable exception. A father or head of the household had the right to sell his unmarried daughter into slavery if she lost her virginity before marriage. Having ensured that the good girls were safe from any taint of sexual indiscretion, it was necessary to supply the bad girls to cater for men's sexual appetites. Solon legalized state brothels, staffed by slaves and aliens. While the good girls composed a single category, wives come mothers, the bad girls were graded from the high-maintenance hetaira, the equivalent of the mistress, to the low-end streetwalker, who could be picked up for a few dollars near the city dumps where people went to defecate. The whore's sexuality was a public convenience. She was viewed in terms of a sewer that drained off men's lust. We have heterae for our pleasure, concubines for our daily needs, and wives to give us legitimate children and look after the housekeeping, Demosthenes, the greatest of the Athenian orators, is reported to have said. This demarcation associating female virtue with sexlessness has been used to dehumanize women to this day. It is not surprising, given the number of boundaries circumscribing women, that men developed something of an obsession with women as boundary crossers. This fascination is graphically illustrated by the Greek interest in the Amazons, the legendary tribe of warrior women who invaded the most male of sanctuaries, organized warfare. The Amazons are a recurring presence in Greek history. This theme has persisted down to modern times. First mentioned by the 5th century historian Herodotus, the father of history, they were depicted as dwelling on the borderlands of civilization, devoted solely to warfare. They sought men only when they needed to mate, and exposed all their male babies, rearing only the females. They are the mirror image of patriarchal Athens. With the Amazons, the fantasy of the autonomous male meets its nightmare opposite, the autonomous female. Men's fascination with warrior women has a long history, from classical Athens to today's comic book heroine Wonder Woman and professional women wrestlers. The Amazons are like these wrestlers in that their combat is fantasy. But for men, the fascination, edged with anxiety, is real. Among the Athenians, it reached obsessive proportions. Representations of battles between men and Amazons are among the most popular depictions of women in antiquity. Over 800 examples survive, the bulk of them Athenian in origin. They decorate everything from temples to vases and drinking bowls. Wherever a citizen looked, his eye would inevitably fall on a scene showing a man, sword or spear raised, hauling a woman by her hair off a horse, or stabbing and clubbing her to death, a javelin pointed at her nipple, as invariably her tunic slips to reveal a breast, and her short skirt rolls up to reveal her thighs. The greatest temple in Athens, the Parthenon, was erected in 437 BC to honour Athena, the city's ruling deity, and to celebrate the Greek victory over Persian invaders. But the battle scene chosen to decorate the shield of Athena was not based on any historical event. It was a depiction of the legendary victory of the hero Theseus, the mythological founder of the city, over an invading army of Amazons. The popularity of this scene cannot be explained merely by the fact that it was the only theme that allowed the artist to portray women naked or partially naked. Convention in 5th-century Athens permitted only men to be depicted nude. The scene reoccurs with the repetitiousness of pornography. But like pornography, the repetition cannot assuage the urge and the anxiety that lies behind it. Male anxiety about women boundary crosses manifests itself most powerfully and memorably in Greek tragedy. All the tragedies that have survived were written by Athenian playwrights during one relatively brief period of the 5th century. Only one of them, Sophocles' Philoctetes, has no woman character. The titles of over half of all the tragedies include either a woman's name or some other female reference. Women were centre stage and in a state of ferocious rebellion. The tragedies nearly always take their characters and much of their plotting from the epics of Homer and his Bronze Age heroes, heroines and villains. It is as if modern novelists followed a convention which obliged them to base all their characters and plots on the legend of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. Questions have therefore been raised about how much these dramas can tell us about the lives and problems of real women. However, the question is not how accurately they reflect the behaviour of real women, but how truly they express society's anxieties about relationships between men and women. No one has doubted that they do. In Euripides' Medea, the eponymous heroine slaughters her children to take revenge on her husband, the Greek mythological hero Jason, when he abandons her to marry another woman. In Aeschylus's Agamemnon, Clytemnestra takes a lover when her husband sails for Troy. She assumes state power and murders him when he returns. In Sophocles' Electra, Agamemnon's daughter goads her hesitating brother Orestes into revenging their father's death by murdering their mother Clytemnestra. Antigone is the story of a woman who defies her uncle Creon, the king, to bury her brother when he has forbidden it on pain of death. She pays for her rebellion by being walled up alive. Euripides' The Bacchae tells how the women worshippers of the orgiastic wine god Dionysus are transformed into Amazons. They rampage around the countryside, sack villages for plunder, defeat a contingent of soldiers in battle, and, in ecstatic frenzy, tear King Pentheus limb from limb when he tries to spy on their activities. The tragedy in each case results when women defy the patriarchal order, breaking temporarily free from the confinement that it imposes upon them. The women do so while asserting the claims of nature. Their rebellion is often in the name of the family, which predates and supersedes the demands of the state. "We'll have no woman's law here while I live," Creon asserts when Antigone declares that her love for her brother obliges her to bury him decently in defiance of the law. In rebellion, the tragic heroines cross the boundary between what is acceptable female behaviour and what is not, thereby becoming masculine, even Amazon-like. As Antigone challenges the law, Ismene warns her defiant sister, "We were born women. We were not meant to fight with men." The message is mixed, if not contradictory. While the playwrights often convey sympathy with women for the suffering and the oppression that goads them into rebellion, the resulting violence and savagery reinforces the underlying anxiety that women are wild and irrational creatures, eruptions of nature who are a threat to the civilized order created by men. This expresses itself in one of the most powerful pieces of misogyny ever penned. In Euripides' Hippolyta, Hippolytus declaims, "Go to hell! I'll never have my fill of hating women, not if I'm said to talk without ceasing, for women are also unceasingly wicked. Either someone should teach them to be sensible, or let me trample them underfoot." While the injustices that women suffer are recognized, so is the necessity for maintaining the patriarchal order that perpetrates them. The sense of woman as the other, the antithesis of man, emerges powerfully from the dramas. This sexual dualism has been a characteristic of Western civilization ever since, partly thanks to Plato and Aristotle, who gave it philosophical and scientific expression. Plato, 429-347 BC, has been called the most influential of all philosophers, ancient, medieval, or modern. His ideas about the nature of the world have spread wherever Western civilization and its most crusading catalyst, Christianity, have taken root, shaping the intellectual and spiritual development of continents and nations that were undiscovered or unexplored at the time those ideas were formulated. Plato's contribution to the history of misogyny is a byproduct of this extraordinary impact, but it is, in some ways, a paradoxical one. Some have hailed Plato as the first feminist, because in The Republic, his vision of utopia, he advocated that women receive the same education as men. At the same time, however, his dualistic vision of the world represents a turning away from the realm of ordinary, mutable existence. This existence, he held, was an illusion and a distraction to be scorned by the wise man. It included marriage and procreation, lowly pursuits with which he identifies women. He himself never married, and exalted the pure love of men for men higher than the love of men for women, which he placed closer to animal lust. His is a familiar enough dualism, identifying man with spirituality and woman with carnal appetites. But Plato gave it a kind of philosophic firepower never seen before. No philosopher's speculations take place in a vacuum. However abstract or obtuse the thought, there are circumstances real enough to help explain it. "Plato was the child of a time that is still our own," wrote Karl Popper. His search for a higher, more perfect world beyond that of the senses took place against the background of years of starvation, plague, repression, censorship, and civil bloodshed. The events that shook the Greek world when Plato was a young man profoundly shaped him. Born into a wealthy Athenian family, he grew up during the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta that lasted almost continuously from 431 BC to 404 BC. Few wars have had such long-term consequences. The impact of the Peloponnesian War on Greece can be compared with that of the First World War on Europe. It led to the ruin of Athens and its empire. It brought about the end of one of the most extraordinary periods of intellectual and artistic achievement that civilization has ever enjoyed. It exhausted Greece, paving the way for conquest first by the Macedonians and then by Rome. In the turmoil and confusion that followed defeat, a vengeful democratic regime forced Plato's beloved mentor Socrates, 469-399 BC, to commit suicide. The Peloponnesian War profoundly influenced Plato's view of the world. This alone makes it a turning point in history. It bred in him a profound distrust, and indeed contempt, for democracy. When Plato envisioned the first utopia, it was as a totalitarian state, rigidly ruled by a permanent elite, the guardians, with an underclass whose only role was to maintain society's economic and agricultural basis. In the world of the Republic, frivolous pleasures such as love poetry and dancing are forbidden. The guardians are allowed no wealth and no form of personal adornment, such as makeup. Plato, who viewed the body as essentially evil, often voices contempt for the mutable world of the senses. In the Symposium, he calls personal beauty a trifle and speaks of the pollution of mortality. So when the current of a man's desires flows towards knowledge and the like, he asserts in the Republic, his pleasure will be entirely in things of the mind, and physical pleasures will pass him by. That is, if he is a genuine philosopher and not a sham. Nothing must be allowed that will distract the elite from contemplating absolute beauty and absolute goodness, surely a recipe, if ever there was one, for absolute dullness. All of Plato's work takes the form of dialogues between Socrates and his pupils. In the Republic, Socrates advocates the integration of selected women into the ruling elite, the guardians, with responsibilities equal to those of men, based on his claim that women and men differ only in their biological roles and physical strength. They will be trained and educated alongside their male compatriots. Men and women guardians will live and feed together and have no private home or property. Mutual attraction between men and women guardians is inevitable, but it would be a sin either for mating or for anything else in our ideal society to take place without regulation. The rulers would not allow it. The aim is to have a real pedigree herd, so the best must breed with the best. The offspring of their unions will be taken away from their mothers immediately upon birth and reared in a communal nursery. The mothers will be spared the time-consuming and exhausting business of breastfeeding their babies. State nurses will do that for them. No parent should know his child or child his parent. By eliminating private property, there will be no need for the father to know his son, since there will be nothing to inherit. In Plato's work, equality for women has been achieved by the denial of the full range of their sexuality. They have become, in effect, honorary men. The only biological distinction acknowledged for them is that of reproduction. Several thousand years later, some radical feminists would make the same claim, that men and women differed solely in their genitalia and that all else was learned behavior. The female guardians are permitted merely to breed and not to bond. Their offspring will be mothered by the state. The control of sexuality is the key to the state's domination of its citizens. It becomes an instrument of state policy. By breaking the bonds of the family, especially the relationship between mother and child, Plato's utopia attacks the notion of individuality itself. All totalitarian ideologies seek to erase individualism in order to ensure that the needs of the state are paramount. The disparaging of mundane pleasures is among the aspects of Plato's utopia that can be found in the totalitarian states of the 20th century. Seeing sex merely in terms of the task of reproducing the pedigree herd foreshadows Nazi Germany's obsession with the breeding of a master race. The sexless status of female guardians would be duplicated by attempts in Maoist China to make men and women indistinguishable in their boiler suits. Most forms of poetry and music were actually banned during the fanatical censorship of the Taliban in Afghanistan in their efforts to create a pure Islamic republic. During their rule, it was even a seditious act to open a hairdresser's salon. From Plato onwards, it has been the goal of every totalitarian regime to stop women from putting on makeup. The Republic also makes it clear that the other can take different forms, in this case racial. Socrates advocates that the natural enemies of the Greeks are the barbarians, just as women are natural enemies of men. The division of the world into warring principles makes it easy to develop exclusive categories of persons. It is no accident that misogyny and racism are often found in the same social environment. Plato's dualism takes on its most powerful philosophical expression in his Theory of Forms. The guardians are expected to grasp it as their guiding wisdom and the most essential part of their education. Without understanding it, they will not know how to distinguish true reality from false. For Plato, the true reality is grasped only by the mind. In the Republic, he writes regarding the Theory of Forms, "We distinguish between the many particular things which we call beautiful or good, and absolute beauty and goodness. Similarly, with all other collections of things, we say there is corresponding to each set a single, unique form, which we call an absolute reality." Plato also equates this higher reality with the good, which is timeless in its perfection. In a discussion about the nature of God, he defines God as the supreme realization of this perfection, scorning the Homeric pantheon in which the gods change themselves into different beings, like magicians. Any change must be for the worse, for God is perfect goodness. Plato's theory of forms is the philosophical basis for the Christian doctrine of original sin, in which the very act of conception is viewed as a falling away from the perfection of God into the abysmal world of appearances, of suffering, and of death. It provided the allegory of Pandora and the fall of man with a powerful philosophical basis. Before this fall, autonomous man lived in a state of harmony with God. A falling away from God is inevitably, with the intervention of woman, a falling away from the highest good. This dualistic vision of reality denigrated the world of the senses, placing it in an eternal struggle with the achievement of the highest form of knowledge, the knowledge of God. This vision profoundly influenced Christian thinkers in their view of women, who literally as well as figuratively embodied what is scorned as transient, mutable, and contemptible. If Plato's theory of forms made misogyny philosophically respectable, Aristotle, 384-322 BC, Plato's pupil, made it scientifically respectable. Because much of Aristotle's science appears to the modern mind as ludicrous, it is easy to forget that his doctrines dominated Western thinking about the world for close to 2,000 years. It was not until the scientific revolution of the 17th century that his ideas were overthrown. Ever since the beginning of the 17th century, almost every serious intellectual advance has had to begin with an attack on some Aristotelian doctrine, observed Bertrand Russell. Aristotle has been described as one of the most ferocious misogynists of all time. His views on women take two forms, scientific and social. Although at times Aristotle was a precise observer of the natural world, his descriptions of various species impressed Charles Darwin, his observations of women were decidedly warped. As a sign of women's inferiority, he referenced the fact that they did not grow bald, proof of their more childlike nature. He also claimed that women had fewer teeth than men, about which Bertrand Russell is said to have commented, "Aristotle would never have made this mistake if he had allowed his wife to open her mouth once in a while." Aristotle introduced the concept of purpose as fundamental to science. The purpose of things, including all living things, is to become what they are. In the absence of any knowledge of genetics or of evolution, Aristotle saw purpose as the realization of each thing's potential to be itself. In a sense, this is a materialistic version of Plato's theory of forms. There is an ideal fish, of which all the actual fishes are different realizations. The ideal is their purpose. When applied to human beings, notably to women, this has unfortunate but predictable results. It becomes a justification of inequality rather than an explanation for it. The most pernicious example is seen in Aristotle's theory of generation. This assumes different purposes for men and women. The male is by nature superior and the female inferior, and the one rules and the other is ruled. The principle of necessity extends to all mankind. Therefore, according to Aristotle, the male semen must carry the soul or spirit and all the potential for the person to be fully human. The female, the recipient of the male seed, provides merely the matter, the nutritive environment. The male is the active principle, the mover, the female the passive, the moved. The full potential of the child is reached only if it is born male. If the cold constitution of the female predominates through an excess of menstrual fluid in the womb, then the child will fail to reach its full human potential, and the result is female. For the female is, as it were, a mutilated male, Aristotle concludes. Much of Aristotle's discussion of women takes place in the context of his treatment of slaves. Slaves, like women, are purposed by nature to be the way they are. Aristotle argues, however, that slaves lack the deliberative faculty, whereas this is granted to women. Nonetheless, this faculty is without authority. Obedience is seen as a woman's natural state in which she achieves her purpose. And women and slaves are similar in one important respect. Their inferiority to their ruler, a master in the slave's case and a husband in the woman's, is permanent and unchanging. The consequences of seeing females as mutilated males could be heard at night in the world of classical antiquity when newborns' cries disrupted the silence. If, good luck to you, you bear offspring, if it is a male, let it live. If it is female, expose it, wrote Hilarion to his wife Alice in 1 BC, testifying to a custom that lasted until Christianity became the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. Unwanted infants were abandoned on rubbish dumps. The majority of those exposed were deformed or sickly males or mutilated males, baby girls. It was such a common practice that the cries of the abandoned babies are unlikely to have disturbed the citizens' repose. Archaeologists studying burial remains in Athens of the 7th century BC made the startling discovery that there were twice as many men as women interred in the plots. By 18 BC, the historian Dio Cassius was lamenting that there were not enough women for upper-class men to marry. Females, one scholar wrote, were selectively eliminated. When combined with high mortality rates during childbirth and abortion, this practice ensured that men always outnumbered women in significant ratios. But not all the exposed daughters died. Because abandoned infants were automatically reduced to slave status, brothel owners frequented dumps searching for baby girls to raise as prostitutes. We will never know how many millions of Pandora's daughters ended up on the rubbish dumps of Greece and Rome, some dying of hunger and cold, others, more fortunate, destined for a life of prostitution. A population imbalance in favour of men has been associated with lower social status for women. Today we find this in parts of India and China, where the selective abortion of female fetuses has meant fewer women than men, and women's status suffers accordingly. Women become scarce goods and are confined to the narrow roles of marriage and child-rearing. Where females outnumber males, on the other hand, they enjoy a corresponding rise in status. Sparta has been cited as proof of this phenomenon. The victor of the Peloponnesian War and the model for Plato's Republic, Sparta was something of an anomaly. It practiced infanticide, but did not discriminate between males and females, only between healthy and sickly babies. All healthy babies were raised, and since males tend to be sicklier than females at birth and have more complications, fewer females were exposed than males. The fact that Sparta was a militaristic state and frequently at war further drastically increased the male mortality rate. Moreover, Spartan women married at an older age than was typical at that time, so they had a better chance of surviving pregnancy. Because women were expected to be strong in order to be fit mothers of Spartan warriors, their health was of concern to the state. To the horror, and no doubt fascination, of the rest of Greece, they exercised naked, took part in athletic games, and generally tended to be stronger and fitter. "Dear Spartan girl with a delightful face, washed with the rosy spring, how fresh you look, in the easy stride of your sleek slenderness. Why, you could strangle a bull." Much to the outrage of Aristotle and other conventional moralists, Spartan women even wore short, revealing tunics. They were able to inherit their husbands' property and manage it. By the 4th century BC, they possessed two-fifths of all Spartan land. The result was a seeming paradox, a militaristic society where women enjoyed greater freedoms and higher status than in Athens, the home of democracy. Sparta faded into oblivion, its treatment of women cited only as an unnatural folly. Plato and Aristotle, on the other hand, survived to become the twin pillars of philosophic and scientific thinking in the Western world, supporting the massive edifice of Christianity. Plato's theory of forms, with its inherent contempt for the physical world, and Aristotle's biological dualism, in which females were seen as failed males, provided the intellectual apparatus for the centuries of misogyny that were to follow.